Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
In this current moment, it has become increasingly clear that U.S. society is deeply entangled in racist policies and logics of white supremacy. While this affects numerous communities, anti-Muslim racism has continued to grow over the years. In With Stones in Our Hands, Reflections on Racism, Muslims, and U.S. Empire, published with the University of Minnesota Press, Sohel Dolatzai and Junaid Rana turn their attention to the intersection of racecraft around Muslims and imperial projects of domination by gathering committed scholars and activists to reflect on how we've gotten here and how we can move forward. The collection of over 20 essays contends with political dissent and the promise of activism, migration and assimilation, suspicion and surveillance, and the intellectual and cultural archives that provide imaginative strategies for possible futures. In our conversation, we discuss the patterns of the Muslim left and the Muslim International, the racialization of Muslims, Palestine and American Muslim politics, Muslim belongings in the context of liberal multiculturalism and settler colonialism, countering extremism programs, the media reinforcement of stereotypes, and the resources Muslims can draw upon for solidarity politics. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. And now my conversation with Sohel Dolatzai and Junaid Rana about With Stones in Our Hands. Welcome, guys. Thanks for joining me on New Books in Islamic Studies. How are you?
Good. Glad to be here.
Yeah, so exciting to talk to you guys about this really wonderful collection of essays you guys have brought together. I think a lot of people working both in kind of an American and North American context, but also in a global context, are really going to benefit from much of this, both in what a lot of these essays put forth, but also in the way you guys can have constructed the volume and the voices you guys are highlighting. So I think it's a really unique contribution that I hope others will kind of follow in your footsteps. But before we get to going through the book, we always start with a little bit about what brought you guys to become the scholars that you are. So perhaps you could talk a little bit about mentors, moments, things that made you interested in the subjects that you are, taking the types of approaches you are, and then let us know like how you guys connected as collaborators, because you guys connect in a lot of ways, not just with this volume. So maybe Junaid, you could start telling us a little bit about how you became the scholar you are.
Sure, I can start off. I think, you know, I can answer this question a lot of different ways, but, you know, the thing that really hits me now, especially when it's very difficult to travel, you know, because of COVID-19, the scholar that I am is primarily because of travel. You know, my family coming from Pakistan, you know, growing up in the States, having this kind of thirst to travel around. I mean, you know, right after undergrad, I spent a year in Cairo. And I think that year in Cairo was pretty formative for me in terms of, you know, thinking about the world, thinking about how the world is constructed, you know, those ways that Edward Said talks about in Orientalism. But also, you know, I got that bug really early on. As much as I hate flying on airplanes, I love traveling the world. And that's really been sort of something that forms how I think about, you know, how to approach things, but also the problems that I see out there. They're not always, you know, sometimes they're constructed for you, but it's also important to understand what that those issues are for yourself. So I think that's how I would answer that question. The other part, I mean, I'm sure Sohel is going to say more about this, but it was, you know, we were introduced to each other pretty early on in our careers, you know, as we were finishing graduate school. And it was kind of like you know, we hit it off immediately. And really this book, this edited volume is kind of a natural progression of our friendship, our seeing each other as comrades and allies and people who, you know, even in the academic world or even in the world of thinking generally, it's not always easy to find people who you see eye to eye with. And Sohel and I were that immediately. And so I think this book is part of our friendship and our friendship with a bunch of people in this book.
In terms of how I came to be an academic, it was, to be honest, it was kind of accidental. my parents moved, from the AFPAC border region. I was born in Peshawar. And, you know, my parents, of course, born there when it was India, but me, Pakistan. So we moved to L.A. and growing up in and around L.A., just being shaped by kind of the political moment. I remember the Iran hostage crisis as a very kind of formative and pivotal time for me and our family in terms of kind of coming to a really stark and, you know, visceral kind of understanding of like how we were being viewed in our place. And, you know, I was a 9-year-old kid, you know, at the time, 9, 10-year-old kid when all this was going down. And so that was like, you know, on top of just coming from a household that was really politically active. And, you know, my father was engaged in hunger strikes against U.S. support for the Pakistani government in his mid-70s. And so just kind of having that constantly in the house and then growing up as a kid, I think, you know, fortunately I could say in the 80s where for me, you know, this has kind of led me to do the work. Some of the work that I do was like my encounter with like culture, like particularly like punk and like hip hop, like, and the way that really shaped my worldview. Another moment was, you know, seeing the Battle of Algiers for the first time as a kid in a library, and being blown away by the power that, you know, film or in other cases music could have in terms of like one teaching you about something, but, you know, shaping a worldview too. So that kind of just led me into when I went to school and then work I did afterward. I was kind of always working in this nexus of, for lack of a better word, like culture and politics, you know, whether it was organizing activist work or working on, you know, film video stuff, you know. And then grad school, I went to the film school at USC, which was a kind of interdisciplinary program and pretty lefty, but, you know, they didn't really contend with questions of difference when it came to race in particular. So, you know, for me, you know, seminal, I mean, I read Malcolm's autobiography as a teenager, but then Fanon and Edward Said became, you know, kind of influential in terms of that. So I went to grad school, to be honest, like really just to get some ideas under my belt, you know, get some film and media and experimental film stuff under my belt, and was just thinking that like I was going to enter the world with that and then I'll see what came of it. And, you know, through the, you know, the powers that be or whatever it might be, landed with a postdoc at UCLA, and that led to me being hired at UC Irvine. And so I kind of embarked on this trajectory of the tenure track in academia, but always kind of a little unsettled with the process, you know, but also trying to figure out how best to navigate it. Because as I moved through it, I started to see the kind of value it had for me in terms of what I could make it or shape it to be. And so I've tried to, you know, kind of navigate that line. And so, you know, luckily, as Junaid was referring to, like early on in my career, I think it was like maybe my first year on the tenure track, I met Junaid, right? You know, we just hit it off, like Junaid said. You know, it was just like, oh, wow, you know? And again, like meeting Junaid and others like him was refreshing, because it was like, oh, you can do this with this worldview and be on the tenure track. Because to be honest with you, my graduate school experience was not that. You know, I was pretty much on my own, you know? And so finding that kind of like community, if you want to call it that, like amongst other junior scholars who were in academia on the tenure track, but in particular, like Junaid, you know, come from a similar background, you know, but had also very similar worldviews, was also really kind of like wind in my sails. And so it kind of just led us to start, you know, talking, thinking, collaborating, and yeah. And it you know, it most recently culminating in this book project, you know?
Yeah, this is, it's interesting too. And, you know, hearing a little bit more about each of your backgrounds and knowing both of your work, you know, you both have these great books that do Islamic studies, I think, in a way that I would imagine neither of you would probably say I'm in Islamic studies. But I think your type of work and what you're doing in this book with Stones in Our Hands carves out, you know, you're making the path by walking of a kind of different trajectory to think about Muslim societies, think about Islam as a kind of category of analysis. So I really appreciate the work that both of you guys are doing and the work that you guys are fostering in a collection like this. But you also have this series with University of Minnesota Press, which uses this framing, which is central to this book as well. This idea of the Muslim International. And in this book, you also talk about the Muslim left. These are kind of two central concepts for the project. So I thought this would be a useful place to start about. So what do you mean by these terms? How are you using them? What is their kind of relationship with each other? And then how does this kind of viewpoint or this kind of starting point, you know, how do you see it operating in the type of scholarship that you guys want to bring to this series that you have? What is the kind of unifying principles in that type of work?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I think for me, well, for us, you know, but I can, you know, I can speak about my perspective on it. You know, I think part of what led us to start thinking about the book was, you know, actually, you know, is there a way, I mean, we understand that the academy is disciplinarily bound, right? But I mean that in all senses of the word, in terms of the ways it also kind of seeks to kind of police forms of thinking and ways of knowing. And for me personally, that just ran completely antithetical to how I understood the world. Like for me, my way of thinking about the world, as I mentioned in terms of my experiences growing up, was just from anything and everything, right? It was all fair game. And so for me, you know, coming into a place like the academy that was disciplinarily bound, for me, I was approaching it from a very undisciplined perspective. And so I say all that to say, because for us, or, you know, the question of what was happening, especially post 9/11, to Muslims, both in the United States and globally, and the way in which, you know, the figure of the Muslim kind of was getting deployed, was not something that was really being understood in relationship to other histories of settler colonial histories and theories of and legacies and afterlives of slavery. What I mean by that, it wasn't being looked at in direct ways around the question of what we might call in the academy critical race or ethnic studies frameworks, right? And so for us, I think it was important to kind of situate what was happening to Muslims and what was called a war on terror within a longer history of empire. And so for us, it was then like trying, like, you know, so in that sense, and we can talk about this maybe, Christian, is like, in what ways is the work that we're doing, you know, overlapping with sometimes, but maybe distinct from Islamic studies, right? Is it something called Muslim studies, right? And what did that mean then for the kinds of work that could be done? How did that reorient us in terms of like looking at, you know, the set of violent concerns that we were kind of facing? So as a result of, you know, that, for us, this idea of like, you know, this question of the Muslim International, you know, was something that I talked about in Black Star Crescent Moon. And it was something that we picked up on and brought to bear on in this project, because I just felt like it was, you know, we felt that it was like an operative frame for thinking about this conjuncture, right? Like this kind of space for thinking about the trafficking and flows of ideas and people and art and resistance, like throughout the world, right? That connected struggles and ideas and histories. And it wasn't that we were naming something that, you know, hadn't existed. In fact, we were, and maybe giving a name to something that has always existed in some ways, right? In many ways. But just trying to get folks to think about what that global flow and circulation of ideas, people, resistances could offer us in terms of thinking about, you know, how to understand systems of violence and domination like empire and war, et cetera. So that was how kind of for me the Muslim International kind of, you know, took root. And there are many ways to think about it. I mean, I don't see it as a monolithic space. I see it as a very kind of heterogeneous and even contested space within it, right? To think about, you know, how questions of settler colonialism and blackness and war and refugee and these kind of questions operate. So it's not necessarily this triumphalist kind of, you know, universalizing space. I do see it as a kind of contested space, but a space where we can hash out and think through certain ideas. And so without talking too much longer, I think then the idea of the Muslim left for us emerges out of and through, right, that conceptual frame, but also that contestation that I was talking about. And to think about forms of political agency that I think, what we felt had been rendered illegible by traditional conceptions of leftist politics, right? So it wasn't that we were asking for or demanding, you know, that the left broaden its tent and now include Muslims in it, right? In fact, we were actually vehemently against that idea. We weren't asking for the left to now include us. We were saying, no, there's a different kind of politics happening that is also anti-imperial, that is also anti-capitalist, that's also looking at changing and challenging patriarchal notions and structures in societies, right? And that, but it doesn't go by the name left, right, in terms of how it's classically defined, but still has a certain kind of, you know, there's a robustness to it, right? And so we wanted to kind of start to think about a way to organize around that kind of political agency, right? And so, because I think, again, and we can maybe have this conversation, for the conventional left, you know, there's a, and as we talked about in the introduction even, and some pieces throughout the book did, there's a deep antipathy, if not antagonism, within the left toward Muslims, right, or Islam. And so we wanted to kind of, you know, stake a particular claim to a kind of set of practices that, you know, had were either being willfully ignored or just not rendered legible, right? And so I think that's the way I'd answer that question.
So really quick, Christian, you know, one of the things that I would add to
Sahel's description is just to go back to my opening around our friendship. And, you know, one of the things that just connected us was just the ability to talk through ideas. And a lot of the stuff that we had been talking about was about, you know, the misrepresentations of Muslims and Islam, both historically, culturally, politically, etc. And, you know, this is a very, that's a very common conversation that you can have with a lot of people, right? You know, once you know something about these worlds, you immediately see it. And we both were engaging in this conversation constantly. And then, you know, part of our, you know, academic careers was about unveiling this, so to speak, you know. And one of the things that we kept coming across, not only in terms of our academic work, but as we presented this material, we talked about it with, you know, we wrote things and those pieces came out and those journal pieces came out, those essays came out, was a kind of pushback. And the pushback was very odd. It wasn't about the ideas we were presenting. It was as if there was another conversation going on that we weren't participating in. And we both knew what that conversation was, and it's precisely that kind of antipathy that Sahel's pointing out, right? That there are certain foils out there that Islam and Muslims stand in for, both in, you know, the modern episteme, but also in the ways that people are constantly imagining their place in the world, right? So, you know, part of what we were trying to figure out was how is it that this colossal edifice has been constructed such that you can't even see the politics of Muslims and the Islamic world writ large, much less the world that's also seen through this lens, right? Because it's not just Muslims per se, the actually existing Muslim, it's other people who are then folded into this narrative, right? And part of us understanding that was to say, on the one, that there is this thing called the Muslim International. And I think, you know, Sahel's book so brilliantly, you know, outlines a slice of what that is, right? That is to say that there were both Muslims engaging in radical sets of politics that were oriented around justice issues. And there were other people, right? Non-Muslims who were engaging with Muslims or Islam, you know, in a way that was internationalist in scope. It presented a kind of radical politics that isn't the way that radicalism has been associated with Islam, right? Radicalism now, it has a very conservative and, you know, a trajectory to it, so that politics is a foregone conclusion for Islam and Muslims, right? It must be something that is antithetical to the, you know, to modernity, or it's antithetical to, you know, the so-called American way of life. But, you know, unpacking those kinds of terms means that you have to understand, one, the way that Muslims and Islams have been constructed from, you know, these huge categories we formerly called the West or whatever, but that there are these ways of seeing these other parts of the world that have nothing to do with those parts of the world. But also, you know, this prefiguring of politics means that it eviscerates any notion that there's a complicated set of political issues going on, that there are debates, that there are, you know, there's even a category of, you know, Muslims who are communists, right? The whole idea of a Muslim being a communist seems like an oxymoron and contradictory. And so that's a central part of what we're dealing with. But it's also, you know, we're not just saying this as a kind of diagnostic, right? To say, like, historically, there are all these, you know, figures we can look at, or all these movements we can look at. But that that this thing that we're calling the Muslim left is also forward moving. It's a way of thinking about, you know, in the book, we talk about, like, we have four interviews with, you know, thinkers and activists and organizers who are involved in organizing a different kind of politics, right? And that different kind of politics means that, you know, not only understanding what the problem is, also leads us to thinking about, well, the other side of this in terms of what is to be done, right? And what is to be done isn't necessarily a prescriptive thing. It's a debate, right? It's a debate in terms of saying, okay, well, what are the forms of action? What are the, what does action actually do, right? So I think that those are the kind of tensions we're building on between the Muslim International and the Muslim left.
Another kind of through line that you guys have both kind of alluded to, but I want to spell it out for listeners, is the kind of racialization of Muslims and kind of thinking about Muslims in this kind of intersection of racism and white supremacy. So can you kind of help us think about the logic of racecraft around Muslims, and then more specifically, perhaps, kind of the operative differences between thinking about anti-Muslim racism versus the categorization of Islamophobia? How do those two kind of, what's the tension there?
So maybe I'll start on this one. And you know, one of the things that we, you know, are responding to here in terms of thinking about this is that, you know, how do we understand racism and white supremacy in relationship to the way that the Muslims are articulated in this, right? So in the introduction, we lay out some of our thinking, and you know, both of us have written in other places about it. Our books also sort of build on some of the ideas around anti-Muslim racism. And, you know, we've also, both of us also worked collectively with a bunch of other academics on a syllabus called Islamophobia is Racism. And that's an online syllabus, which is, you know, very useful in terms of sets up a set of readings and how to think about this in terms of the realm of the problem. And one of the reasons for us to turn to racism as opposed to something like Islamophobia, I mean, one, Islamophobia has, you know, there's all these kinds of built-in logics within the notion or the word or the concept or the definition of what Islamophobia is itself, right? One, that it's somehow psychologized, right? That as a phobia, there's just a fear of Islam and Muslims, and if we just got to know Islam and Muslims, you know, the world would be okay with it. And what we're saying is that, no, that's not exactly what's happening here. What's happening here is connected to a longer history of racism and white supremacy that isn't just about knowledge. Knowledge is being wielded in particular ways, and that this is not a problem of ignorance, right? Which is also another way that people often talk about racism. It's just things that people don't know about, right? But what we're saying here is that not only is racism also used by very intelligent people, is very educated people, very literate people. It's also something that is constantly changing in itself. So one of the lines that we have in the introduction, I'll just read it really quick. In our thinking, anti-Muslim racism does not only draw from anti-Black or settler colonial logics. Instead, the racialized Muslim is a planetary figure that is neither universalized nor uniform, as we have been describing. It is a horizon, a possibility, a potential that is placed within temporal and spatial context as described in the numerous approaches within this volume. So there's a lot being said here, right? So what we mean by this is that we don't think there's one anti-Muslim racism. Right? There's multiple forms of anti-Muslim racism. And we would even argue that racism in itself is a kind of pluralization of forms of domination and oppression, right? And part of the problem often is that people want to understand racism as one thing, but it has multiple tentacles. It has, you know, it works in different ways in different settings. So part of the job that we have to do is to understand how complicated that thing is, right? But we're also saying that, you know, anti-Muslim racism has a trajectory that's global. Right. It's not just found, even though we, you know, for the most part in the book, we're focusing on North America and somewhat on Europe, but it's a global planetary thing. Like you can find it all over the world. You can find it being practiced against the Uyghurs in China. It can be, you can see it in the refugee crisis around the world, the way that refugees are dealt with. So, you know, all these examples are not the same, right? They share some kind of parallels conceptually, but they have to be sort of understood on the ground in terms of like the ideological and conceptual work that's being applied to those groups and peoples, right? And so, you know, one of the things that we also are doing in terms of naming this as racism is to think in terms of the politics of that, right? Which is the legacies of how we turn to, so for example, the Black radical tradition, which gives us a lot of anti-racist thinking, but also helps us to think through, you know, forms of solidarity, how political solidarity in terms of acting against racism means not only acting against the racism that you face, right, individually, but or even collectively, but that other groups of people face, right? That to understand, you know, anti-Muslim racism is to also put it in, you know, in connection to anti-Black racism, to, you know, Native genocide and anti-immigrant discourses, etc. And that by doing that kind of work, you know, those ways of thinking, that's for us a kind of social movement thinking that we're trying to bring analysis into not only the academy, but also how we, again, you know, think about that same question that I talked about previously, what is to be done?
That's a great answer. I have very little to add to that. You know, I think this is a fundamental question, Christian, because, you know, one of the, you know, classic kind of, you know, knee-jerk responses to this idea that Muslims face racism is, well, Muslims are not a race, right? Or that it's not really racism, it's religious persecution, right? And in fact, when you look at kind of the body of work called critical race theory within, you know, legal studies, there are those who kind of approach, you know, kind of redress that, you know, in terms of like legal redress or remedy for violence enacted upon Muslims in the United States, like they're not able to pray at work or they're not able to, you know, do certain kinds of things or seen as suspicious, is through kind of ideas of religious persecution and constitutional protections of those freedoms, right? And so even within, in terms of like how legal remedies are getting meted out, and I think that is just, and I'm not saying that's everybody, but I think that tends to be kind of like one of the mainstream kind of currents in terms of like thinking about not just within the law, but how to understand what it is that Muslims are facing, right? And for us, it was really important to kind of try to not necessarily just unpack that, because we were trying to think through like historically, what is this nexus of religion and race, right? Like the idea that, you know, and again, as some scholars have written about, that race is essentially the secularization of religion, right? Like there's a way of thinking about kind of political theology and thinking about these ideas where race becomes a way of secularizing religion, that at the core of the idea of race is a certain kind of conception, a theological conception about the human and who's considered saved and not saved, or human and not human, right? And so what we were also trying to do was kind of tap into that kind of history and to kind of suggest or show that, like, you know, even though it's happening to people called Muslims who, you know, practice a religion called Islam, right? That, as Junaid, like, you know, brilliantly pointed out, like, the way in which it's practiced upon Muslims, right, is rooted in deeper histories of white supremacist violence, right? And then when we think about empire, not just U.S. empire, kind of, if we want to look at post-World War II period, but even kind of, you know, we can go back to, I mean, we could go back to the 1619 project or whatever you want to say, but we can talk about, like, European expansion and colonization of the world and kind of like what that emerges out of and the way in which the figure of the Muslim comes to kind of haunt kind of the spaces of what Europe considers civilization, right? So this idea of the figure of the Muslim, which is in some ways overlaps with Muslims themselves, but as Junaid referenced earlier, sometimes doesn't, right? The figure of the Muslim gets deployed as a kind of haunting figure, a racialized figure that kind of can construct what is and is not white, who is and who is not human, et cetera. And so I think for us, that was really important to kind of also, you know, try to kind of connect some of those dots.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Now, in this book, you guys, I mean, your bench is stacked here. You really have brought together a number of really wonderful folks. So can you tell us a little bit about, like, how did this thing come together? You know, you kind of pointed to kind of building this kind of collective of friends and colleagues over time that had the same kind of resonance in terms of, you know, political thought and these kind of things. So, but where did this project come from? How did you, you know, gather these people? How did you get them focused to think about the same thing? You also mentioned this part of the book, which I think is really unique, where you interview organizers and activists. So what led to including those voices as well? Maybe you could kind of just give us a little history of the project.
Yeah, I could start with that. I mean, you know, as we were talking about, like, me and Junaid had, you know, when we first met, just kind of thinking about, you know, to go back to Junaid's question, quoting, referencing Shariati, referencing Marx, like, what is to be, what can we do here, right? Like, where's the intervention? And trying to think about things that kind of influenced us. And for us, in some ways, we wanted this to be a kind of handbook. Might be a little thick to kind of put in your back pocket, as it were, but, like, for us, we wanted it to kind of be in that tradition of kind of like a handbook, like a kind of, you know, not, you know, maybe not necessarily manual, might sound too programmatic, but we were thinking about, you know, like the Insight Women of Color Against Violence kind of anthology that collective had put out, you know, several years ago as a kind of model, right? And trying to, you know, as we were saying, think through some of these ideas. And also at the same time, I mean, this was an idea that, I mean, we started talking about this book, you know, it's been a while, Christian. I mean, it's probably been like, you know, last maybe 8-10 years ago, right, where we really started to think about, like, what if we put together a collection? And part of that process was you know, the social life of the war on terror, like what it was doing to, you know institutions on the one hand, but just, you know, how it was impacting Muslims and the everyday. was something that was almost, it was disorienting because it was happening so rapidly and so quickly. Every other day, there was something else. And so it was almost like we were chasing a moving target in a way, in terms of trying to, you know, harness or get a sense of what was going on. And so at the same time, I think there was also a generation of scholars who were coming through the pipeline, as it were, who, you know, again, in terms of thinking about that community, who were likewise shaped by kind of critical race, Black studies, ethnic studies, gender studies frameworks, who were coming through and also trying to make sense of this thing called the War on Terror. And so as a result, like the book took some time to kind of get like the pieces together to fit, right? In terms of like, okay, what are the broad ideas? What could specific chapters be about? You know, who are the people out here who are doing this work? Because essentially what we wanted to do to kind of, in the book, like I said, was one, provide this, you know, handbook as it were, and include critical voices, right? We wanted critical voices because that was something that we felt was just not happening in a moment of intense violence and subjection for Muslims. So we wanted critical kind of voices to come together, but also to kind of couple that with like folks who weren't in the academy, and not that the academy is this kind of insular space, it can be, unfortunately, but we wanted not only to bring those folks in the academy who were, you know, trained scholars, but who were also doing, you know, activist work, right, and organizing work. But then we also wanted to tap into our networks of organizers and activists who were, you know, also well-versed in thinking through kind of larger, bigger scholarly ideas and bringing that to bear on their organizing work. And so for us, you know, it was, you know, Lara Kiswani at AROC up in the Bay Area. They do amazing work up there. And so bringing Lara's voice in, Hami Khan here in LA, where I've done work with and Stop LAPD Spying, and he's kind of like a fixture here and kind of like LA kind of like radical politics in terms of like, you know, addressing kind of LAPD's historic, but especially in the War on Terror, kind of the way in which LA became and has become kind of the epicenter of the interface between local policing and Homeland Security, with William Bratton as the police chief and then Michael Downing and the funding that comes through LA as a result. So Hamid has been intrinsically and like just involved in the way in which, and this is what's important to a point that Junaid made, how the War on Terror uses the figure of the Muslim and got buy-in from mainstream Muslim communities here in Los Angeles, right, as a way of kind of protecting communities. But the overwhelming bulk of the force of what LAPD was doing with its surveillance architecture was targeting non-Muslim Black and brown communities, right? Over 90% of their stops and SARs, suspicious activity reports they did essentially, were targeting non-Muslims. So again, how does the figure of the Muslim get deployed, right? So terror is being expanded, the idea of what a terrorist is. So Hamid, we wanted to bring Hamid in. And then there was, you know, Fahad Ahmed from Drum, like a longtime organizer in New York around kind of undocumented migrant kind of Muslim Desi communities there, many of whom were Muslims. And then Ubaydullah Evans, kind of a thinker, activist, organizer in Chicago who, you know, was thinking through questions around like liberation theology, Black liberation theology in specific. So we wanted to kind of bring these multiple voices and to create kind of a, you know, if it wasn't necessarily a monolithic, it wasn't like a chorus, you know, like everyone singing in unison. For me, maybe if I could use that metaphor, it was more like a cacophony. It was just like, we wanted dissonant voices and tones and, you know, shrieks and yells from, you know, for the book to kind of have this collection of these critical kind of voices that were unsettling kind of established ways of thinking about, you know, who Muslims are and what's happening to us, you know? So,
you know, certainly it is an all-star squad. And, you know, that was a little bit of the idea to bring folks who are doing this work. And, you know, we gave them the direction, basically take on something that, you haven't been able to deal with in your academic work, and you want to work out and you want to share with others. And, you know, I think there's no blueprint for any of these pieces. They all came out like, and they're addressing different stuff, and you know, they're using different voices, different writing strategies, etc. Also, the interviews came out like they're all very different, all four of them. And I think, you know, one of the things that we wanted is just, again, like to show all of the kind of debate and different directions. Believe it or not, we actually wanted more pieces in here. And because of people's schedules and, you know, the timing of everything, not everybody could be along with it. But, you know, we could easily see us doing another one of these. And you know, it was a lot of work, but I think it the way it came out, and, you know, one of the kind of weird tragedies of it, if there is one, if something like that, is that this is not something, even though this book came out 2 years ago, we can still talk about this stuff now like it's fresh, you know. And I do think that that's one of the kind of legacies around this massive thing called the War on Terror, where not only is it just confined to moments of time, it's so massive that we just can't, we're just starting to scratch the surface. And I think there's a lot of work coming out now that also kind of continues on with this. Many of the authors in this volume have books come out or have had books come out that are kind of in tandem with the pieces that they wrote. So that's, I think it was also a source book in that sense for folks to like come to this book and then build off of it. And, you know, one of the things you mentioned before, like it also kicked off our series at the University of Minnesota Press. And we kind of see that space as a place to continue to have this conversation. You know, it's not the only place, but it's one of the places. So,
it's the best place.
You know, it's an all-star game, right? So, like, you know, we want to basically have this conversation growing, and, you know, it's again about creating the debate itself, right? And moving the debate. I mean, the other thing that I wanted to say too about this, in terms of the all the pieces in it, and I'm so glad, and we were so fortunate to get the people that who contributed, is that each of the sections also, you know, part of the idea of it sort of ending with the interviews was to sort of frame it in. You know, there are these concepts that we're working with in all of these sections, right? So, you know, it's, you know, the first section is on imperial racism, what's imperialism, what's racism, the Palestine question, two, decolonizing geographies, how do we unpack all these different ways of thinking about place and all of that kind of stuff. The third section is technologies of surveillance and control. And the final section, possible future dissent and the protest tradition, is that, you know, particularly in that last section, what is this thing called a protest tradition? And I think that's what each of the sections really builds on. You know, what's the problem? How do we diagnose it? What are the concepts that we need to think about? And then what are our strategies? What are our practices? What's our tradition around this? So that's the way we were really thinking about how we organize the book.
There's over 20 chapters, so it'd be impossible to get into the weeds of all these particular essays. But perhaps we can kind of spend a couple minutes just kind of teasing out some of these themes of these sections. The first one seems to be around issues of things like political dissent or freedom to critique. And perhaps the promise of activism. So maybe how do some of these essays address issues like Palestine or the effects of anti-Muslim racism in this context of kind of this imperial form of racism?
I mean, I think, and again, it was these were not easy decisions to make in terms of thinking about how to give shape to these sections. But I do think they cohere relatively well. I mean, obviously, in the imperial racism question was thinking about, again, in some ways, you know, the centrality of race to the question of imperialism, right? Which taps into a larger history of what Cedric Robinson has called racial capitalism. But thinking about the way in which that manifests in relationship to particularly either Muslim communities per se, or how Muslim communities are constructed, or again, how the figure of the Muslim gets, weaponized, as it were. And we see that most clearly, obviously, in the Palestine question, right? And so, you know, Stephen Salaita's piece on, I mean, hopefully everyone knows about the kind of persecution that Stephen has faced, but Stephen's piece, as well as, you know, Rabab Abdul Hadi's pieces in that section, and they both talk about kind of the way in which Palestine is kind of made exceptional in a particular way to thinking about quote unquote progressive or left politics, or even kind of ideas of freedom of speech, right? And the way in which kind of, you know, the figure of the Muslim, you know, hovers around that exceptionality, right? And so thinking about that question in terms of like, how do these kind of very like celebrated ideas of political dissent and freedom of speech and the left kind of start to kind of crumble when we start to think about how the figure of the Muslim, you know, starts to circulate, right? These ideas all of a sudden fall apart, or exceptions start to get made. And then, you know, I think Stephen Shehi's piece is a great piece on terms of thinking about, again, how the liberal wing of, you know, the U.S. war party called the Democrats kind of, you know, shape a particular narrative against like Islam and Muslims, right? Like how, again, even within kind of the liberal corridors of power, anti-Muslim racism kind of structures, you know, their own politics. And I think that picks up on what Abdullah and Hafsa did with kind of the limits of kind of domesticating our politics in terms of thinking about, you know, how the nation state and ideas of Americanness kind of, you know, foreclose or silence kind of critiques of U.S. empire and the way in which we should think about, you know, this question of war, right? We think of war as only happening somewhere else, but I think part of what we were trying to do was destabilize some of these kind of boundaries in this thinking, and to think about, like, you know, in particular, I mean, we can think about, you know, how even the U.S. itself, I mean, we're not making this up. I mean, the National Defense Authorization Act, we mentioned this in introduction, in 2012, says that the world is a battlefield, right? And the 2004 9/11 Commission report refers to the American homeland as the planet, right? So if American homeland is the planet and the world is a battlefield, then this question of where war is happening and what is war has to be reconceptualized, right? Instead of only thinking about it as something happening outside, right? And that has profound impact on how we think about then policing, surveillance here in the country, in the U.S., et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's what we were trying to get at in that section, you know?
Yeah, and all these really connect, because the decolonizing geography section, which has, again, several excellent essays, talks about issues of migration and assimilation in this kind of global politics, where we're thinking about the Muslim subject, both in the North American context, but here also in Europe. So can you tell us a little bit about what these authors were thinking about in terms of Muslim belonging in perhaps these transnational context? How does it perhaps create some tension with liberal ideas of multiculturalism?
Janae, do you want to go over that one?
No, you could do it.
Okay. All right, I'll do it. I mean, I'd love to talk about this stuff. So, no, I mean, this was, you know, we bring in a couple of pieces from Europe. You know, Fatima Al-Tayeb is talking about kind of the language of multiculturalism in Europe and where Muslims fit in that. And then Salim Nadi, who's part of kind of the kind of decolonial party there in France, in terms of thinking about, again, how these ideas are being played out in the context of Europe, where the Muslim kind of, you know, the refugee figure is a prominent figure, but also the history of colonialism. You know, I mean, America has this narrative, the United States has this narrative of itself as not an empire and not, you know, having, you know, colonies, as it were. And of course, we know that to be a fiction, but, you know, Europe in some ways fully admits to that, right? And so as a result, there's this whole history of colonial subjectivity that both those pieces are kind of speaking to in terms of then how the language around multiculturalism gets deployed, but it's still constructed within and against the Muslims. The Muslims are somehow the exception to the multiculturalist project, and not just the exception, they're a threat to the multicultural project, right? The way they act, the way they dress, what they believe, or what they think politics are, right? The Muslim in many ways, not just in Europe, but here is, and you know, I think this is part of what we also gesture toward is the limit of the political, right? Like the Muslim exceeds the political. And so therefore then if it's a threat to the political, then it must be, you must, in order to protect, you know, the human or the human community, you must then extinguish or kill the Muslim, right? To put it in kind of crude terms. And so I think those pieces kind of start to get at that, as do others in the book, but Abbas's piece on Atlanta and the way in which the civil rights kind of history kind of, you know, like permeates the cityscape in terms of thinking about his work and the legacies of Black Islam in the city of Atlanta, I think is really interesting as a kind of counterpoint. And thinking about Imam Jamil and kind of other figures in Atlanta who kind of, you know, were working within or underneath that kind of specter of civil rights. Arash Davadi's piece is a really, like, I think an amazing cogent piece about kind of Iranian diaspora, particularly here in LA, where he grew up, and thinking about their kind of complicities with kind of U.S. empire and, you know, kind of imperial like postures toward Iran in terms of the way in which they mobilize the Iranian diaspora, not in total, but the dominant thread is this kind of anti-Muslim kind of, you know, take on this, you know, what happened to our country. Look at the revolution of 79. And even so-called leftists from Iran in terms of the way in which they mobilize those kind of anti-Muslim rhetorics. So, and then, of course, we talked about the interview already that that Junaid does with Fahad and Drum. So I think, you know, for us, like, we were trying to kind of, like you said, cohere around certain questions about how space and liberal ideas kind of converge and how, you know, anti-Muslim racism is operative in all those.
I mean, the other thing I'd say about these pieces in particular is that this section, you know, a lot of the essays were thinking about one, formal politics, right? What is the shape of formal politics and how do Muslims fit in within that? But then also how migration fits into that, right? So migration, whether it be through legal frameworks or through political frameworks, what is it that's constructed as the figure of the Muslim? You know, and part of having the work of Drum highlighted at the end of this is to think about, you know, something where you've got a worker-based collective where their organizing model is precisely working against the notion of formal politics necessarily, right? That, you know, for example, electoral politics is the only way to do politics. You know, Drum does things in a different way because they're trying to imagine politics in a different way. And I think that provides a kind of resource for folks who are looking who are thinking that, you know, in the same ways that a lot of people do, that formal politics is kind of a dead end in a way. And so what are our options? And there's a lot of options, and historically there have been a lot of options. And so the work that Fahad's doing with Drum is one of the resources that we have.
Now, the technologies of surveillance and control revolves a lot around ideas about suspicion of Muslims, but then specifically tied to different types of power. So things like public assumptions that are rooted in these kind of countering violent extremism projects, the media reinforcement of stereotypes, Orientalist discourses on human rights. This section seemed to cover a lot of ground, so perhaps it will, you know, you don't have to feel overly required to try to summarize everything. But what are the type of the possibilities of activism in such a context where there's these kind of multi-pronged oppressions or obstacles being put forth in this kind of social life of Muslims?
It's interesting. I mean, you know, I think the current conjuncture with, you know, the police killing of George Floyd and what has emerged out of that in terms of defunding and even abolishing kind of the police and the carceral state, I think really bring into kind of bold relief, you know, many of the issues that we were kind of touching upon in the book, right? Because I think it raises, like I mentioned earlier, fundamental questions about how we conceptualize warfare, right? And obviously there's a deep history and I think a righteous history that pinpointed and hit the nail on the head about what the role of the policing function in the United States has historically been about kind of counterinsurgency, right? In terms of thinking about Black political mobilization and that possibility, right? And so, meaning it was a kind of warfare, right? And so what I think, you know, the pieces in this section, but in other parts of the book as well, get at is how do we try to draw these connections to, in particular, technologies of control, forms of surveillance that, as many people are arguing now, have kind of boomeranged back, right? The war on terror has come home, right? You hear this narrative of the militarization of the police. And while I can agree with the impulse to name it that, like, my argument would be that the police have always been militarized in this country, right? But I understand what they're saying because, you know, they're essentially arguing that there's, you know, separate pots of money. And, you know, there's the kind of infamous kind of Pentagon 1033 program that was enacted in 1997 that allowed military weapons from one pot to then go to policing. And so I get what they're trying to argue, but I think what's happening in the new conjuncture is we're seeing kind of in more, you know, obvious ways, the use of military drone surveillance technologies that have been deployed in other theaters of war, Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, you know, Sudan. And now they're kind of being brought to bear, whether it be through threat of, you know, the military taking the streets here in the United States over the protests that Trump kind of put forth. But if it's not literally the military taking the streets, it's still the tactics and strategies because, you know, as we know, there's been a lot of training of the police here with the military abroad and with the State of Israel and vice versa. The military here comes and trains with local police on how to do kind of their work. So I think this section was kind of trying to get at some of those questions with Ronick's piece on drone technology, and the way in which that operated. And then, you know, the legal frameworks that come into play, and that's what Shireen was getting at with her piece on how the law is being weaponized in a particular way to think about a kind of genetic disposition of violence that Muslims might have. So that would be some of the ways that I would kind of try and address that in terms of, you know, thinking about it. I think it's very relevant for what's happening right now.
I mean, the other thing that I think brings these pieces together, even though this is happening throughout the book, it's how did some of these ideas around anti-Muslim racism travel, right? So like whether it's through technology, whether it's through, you know, the discipline of psychology, how psychologists are using this, how it's mobilized in human rights discourse, the way it's being used in education and pedagogy, or even in film. Right. I mean, all of these things are things, they're discourses, but they're also practices that travel themselves. Right. And so that's one of the ways we can think about how the global is enacted upon. Right. The classic one is the way that Ronick talks about it in terms of drone warfare. Right. How do you think about race in the context of drones, and what are the multiple ways that, you know, on the one hand, what is the military doing, but then what are the ways that activists are undoing these logics through, you know, documentary film work, et cetera, in terms of thinking about like those things we know and don't know.
The final section was great, partly because I think these are the types of essays that you're talking about that aren't going to get the space in other types of work. And this, you talk about the kind of possible futures is what you call this section, but it's really covering a wide gamut of traditions, approaches. In this context, I mean, there's lots of different ways we could take it, but perhaps one of the important through lines of this section is the role of women and gender. Both it's central for many of these authors. So how do you think Muslim women fit into the possibility of a Muslim left? And perhaps are there particular challenges in terms of perhaps gendered norms that might prohibit this type of progress?
Could you say more about that question, Christian? I mean, so what is it about gender that you're trying to get at?
Well, in the sense of, you know, some of these authors are talking about both being women, raising women, and kind of what does that intersection of race, religion, gender, what are the kind of possibilities that creates? What are perhaps the challenges that those set up before those people?
No, I mean, I think, you know, picking up on how you originally framed the question, I mean, I think when it comes, and this is what I suggested before, that the Muslim International and even the Muslim left are kind of, you know, these are not uniform, monolithic spaces. These are contested spaces, right? But they're a space that where we can kind of have kind of like these very important kind of debates, right? And so to me, like the question of gender is central to the Muslim left, right? In terms of thinking about how our politics, you know, are shaped, right? And the struggles in which kind of, in particular, Muslim women have to endure. So I think the pieces speak to that. I think, you know, Suad's piece is, you know, both tonally, but in terms of like the register she's speaking, like the genre and tradition out of which the piece is coming from, I think is a very powerful kind of invocation of that history, but also kind of placing it in the now in terms of thinking about, you know, for her as a Black Muslim woman intellectual, right? In terms of how she frames kind of her positionality vis-a-vis, you know, patriarchy writ large within Muslim communities, but it's, you know, particularly also in relationship to kind of immigrant, you know, non-Black Muslim community spaces. So, and I think Sylvia's is a kind of more, you know, also deeply personal, but from the perspective of her daughters, kind of thinking about what it means to raise them in this context. So I think I think you're right to say, ask the question about gender, but I think this piece, this chapter, this section of the book also gets at how, you know, some Muslim women are thinking about these questions. And I appreciate Sylvia's piece in the question, in terms of the question of mothering. And, you know, there's a whole kind of discourse that's emerged around kind of the radical politics of mothering, et cetera. And I feel like Sylvia's piece is, you know, gesturing toward that. So I think, you know, that the question of gender and the place of gender within this idea of the Muslim left is fundamental, right? And it's something that has to, I mean, it's something that's going to be contested, and we have to continually fight for that, you know? I don't know if, Junaid, you have something to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in some ways, you know, we talked about this when we were organizing the book in terms of the sections, and we didn't want this, even though this is like, you know, future oriented, and it gives you kind of like this direction. It really wasn't about, okay, this is it. This is more, for us, it was more about completing a circle and bringing us back to, you know, one of the things that comes up in the opening section with Rubab Abdelhadi and her notion of indivisibility of justice, which is, again, a kind of social justice call that always brings to the fore intersectionality. And intersectionality, not just an analytical, but as a justice-oriented approach, thinking about forms of oppression in their connection to one another. And, you know, part of what's so powerful about the pieces in this section, whether it's Sawad's or Robbins or Hotham's or Sylvia or Merriam's, is that all of them are really bringing a very personal, very kind of political framing to something that is deeply, deeply important and also that needs to change, right? So, you know, for us, it's a direction of like, yeah, this is going to be an ongoing conversation, but it's also, you know, we have mechanisms from which to think about this stuff. We have strategies in place to think about this stuff. I also have to point out that I think these were, you know, some of the most beautifully written essays, right? I mean, they were in a different kind of voice. You know, Sawad's piece is very powerful because it's just a fierce piece in terms of taking on how she sees her place, right? And what it means to be, like as she says, a young Black Muslim woman intellectual. And naming that as such and giving the power to all of that in the way that it can be given power to. And I think that's some of the work we have to do here is about reflecting and thinking about, you know, how does intersectionality, what does that mean for the Muslim International? What does that mean for the Muslim left? In a way, we've kind of laid it out in all kinds of different ways, but I think it also has a particular meaning when you're also talking about, you know, social movements, right? And that's what Rabab Abdulhadi is referring to in terms of the indivisibility of justice, that these struggles need to be constantly addressed and rethought. And something as simple and straightforward as responding to the question that, you know, a daughter might pose to you, or, you know, I think all of us, particularly academics in office hours, where, you know, there are students who come to us with particular kinds of issues, and they're not easy. You know, they're not straightforward, and there's some very painful questions that are being asked, and they need to be asked. And I think that's part of what's going to, again, push things forward. And, you know, in many ways, like, it's hard to be prescriptive about this, right? Because there's no one answer. There are multiple answers. And I hope that we sort of like are, you know, starting off this conversation.
Yeah, I've talked to you much longer than I often do, so I'm sorry to keep going on and on. There's so much in this book.
We could keep going. Yeah.
Well, perhaps this might be a good place to think about what you both are working on now and the things that you do have coming out in the future, either through your series, your own personal scholarship, other types of things that you guys are working on. Perhaps Sohail, you could tell us a little bit first about what's going on with you.
Wow. I'm kind of trying to, you know, figure that out myself. I mean, I think I was in Cuba a while ago and, you know, went down with a camera. And so I've been kind of thinking about, you know, kind of, you know, reflexing those muscles a little bit. You know, I had directed a music video for a group called Algiers that came out late last year. And so trying to think about kind of like the space of the moving image and film, in terms of, you know, its role in kind of shaping the idea of memory. There's a tradition of that within kind of experimental film practice. And so I'm really playing with this idea of the ghost archives, in terms of thinking about, how can we kind of think about, you know, the figure of the Muslim or Muslims in particular, in spaces that have been erased or silenced or deemed illegible. So I'm really working around this project around Cuba and Guantanamo, in terms of thinking about, you know, how the figure of the Muslim is kind of circulating within that. And so using kind of film as a medium, but then also kind of other forms of like writing to kind of complement that. So it doesn't have particular shape yet, but I've just been kind of wrestling with some of those ideas and those mediums, you know, like, I've always really appreciated the convergence of the image with text. And so trying to think through that in terms of some of these issues. So that's broadly speaking, that's kind of what I'm working on right now.
So I've got two projects I'm working on. One is in the writing phase and one's in the research phase. The one that I'm writing, I'm finishing up this book that is an ethnography of a Brooklyn neighborhood. It's basically a neighborhood ethnography that looks at this little Pakistan in Brooklyn in terms of the changes that have happened in the last two decades. So, you know, some of the pieces that I've written about this, you know, in journal articles and edited anthologies are out there. There's a couple pieces out there. So that'll give you a little taste of what I'm thinking about in terms of the book. And then the second project, huge, actually. it started off very small because, you know, one of the things that we're interested in, or that I'm interested in, is you know, the life of Dada Mir Hadar Khan, who was a sailor in the early 20th century who traveled all over the world and spent a significant time in the States, and then joined the Communist Party, was dispatched to Moscow, and then ended up in India, started a Communist Party in South India, and then, you know, after partition, he spent the rest of his life in Pakistan. So it's pretty much using his life story to detail a history of the third world left, you know, because he basically came in contact with all of these people that I'm trying to trace both archivally and, you know, through oral history. Some of the oral histories I've begun to sort of collect in terms of people who were his comrades in Pakistan, in terms of like their remembrances of him, their contact with him, but then also just giving me more details about his life, because he has a memoir that he wrote that was basically up to partition. And that's just half of his life, because he lived, you know, till he was in his late 80s. And so that book, I mean, as it comes together, you know, I'm not really sure where it's going, but it will be a story about, the third world left.
That's great. Well, congratulations on, this great book, With Stones in Our Hands. Thanks for making the time to talk about it. Good luck on your own projects. And, I'm glad you're supporting and getting such interesting work out with the series. I always have my eye on that, so I hope listeners will also check it out in the future. And thanks again, guys.
Thanks, Christian. All right. Thank you, Christian.